This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to another Joy 94.9 podcast.
Hi, it's Pete Dillon here. You're on Cravings on Joy 94.9. Today we're going to take a galloping gourmet journey around Victoria. We're going to look at wine, we're going to look at beer, we're going to look at, well, Christmas in July. It's all happening today and tomorrow. And we're going to talk about about Victoria and putting it on your table. All that and more, so you best go and pop the cork out of a bottle of something, top up a glass, sit back, and see if you can try and match my hangover. The man responsible for that hangover is sitting beside me. It has something to do with the consumption of red wine and cocktails in Smith Street, Collingwood. Glenn James, welcome to Cravings.
Thanks, Pete.
Glenn James is originally from New Zealand. He is a group winemaker for Australia's largest beverage company, is that?
Yeah, it's by value, the world's largest winemaker.
There you go. There's how many brands in this stable?
Around 50.
So a group red winemaker would do what?
Well, it's a funny title, I guess, for a winemaker, but wine making in a large company with many wineries, lots of winemakers. There has to be another level of winemaking above that just to coordinate all our winemaking teams, where fruit goes, to which winery, to make sure the styles and quality is, you know, overarching.
So you're the quality control boss?
Quality control in terms of taste and style.
Okay. Yeah. So how did you become a winemaker? Because this wasn't always your career, was it?
No. I guess I stumbled into it. I was doing horticulture in New Zealand, I was in university for a while, but discovered the grape through drinking Pinot,
right,
a long time ago in New Zealand, and found out that you could actually do it as a job.
And Pinot's still a fond love of yours.
Evidently.
Yeah, not of mine this morning. Thank you very much. So you started, you went to Roseworthy College now, we might need to explain to the listener.
Hence coming to Australia from Christchurch. At that time, the only place to do an undergraduate course was in South Australia at the Roseworthy Ag College, and did the Bachelor of Winemaking for 3 years, and haven't left the shores since, really.
So you've been stuck in South Australia?
I have. All over the place, but living in South Australia, yes.
Our deepest sympathies for you.
Okay.
So you went to BRL Hardy, you've been to South Corp, it was taken over by Foster's.
Yes, lived through that, yes.
So you were originally a group white wine maker with Foster's?
I've been really living and breathing white wines for many years. Made a lot of Chardonnay in my time.
Right.
But look, my passions have evolved, and Riesling, wine styles of all varieties and shapes and sizes out of Tasmania.
Mm-hmm.
I just fell in love with and have really pushed that within my roles, and have now sourced quite a bit of fruit and wines from Tassie. And then I think through attrition and somehow luck, I've ended up moving to red very recently, which I knew all those wines anyway. I'm a wine judge at various wine shows around the country, so I do know my reds.
Let's do a quick wine making 101. Okay. I would start with getting a whole bunch of grapes.
Mm-hmm.
I would crush the bejesus out of them. The liquid falls out.
Mm-hmm.
I would put that in a big stainless steel tank. I would add a bit of sugar, let it make alcohol.
Sugar?
And put it into...
No sugar?
No. Okay, I'm making beer then, aren't I?
Well, if in New Zealand or in France, you can add sugar, but not in Australia. No.
So am I right by saying we sort of get this grape juice, we chuck it into a big stainless steel vat, it makes its own alcohol, and then they chuck it into a bottle under a screw cap or a cork?
That sounds so industrial. That's one way of doing it, and it's all a matter of scale and wine style. There's so many different ways of making grapes turn into wine. You can either use Jesus, or you can
use Jesus.
Yeah, we did that. It was water into wine.
Ah, of course.
Yeah.
I was about to say, how do you use Jesus to make wine? It's clearly something that does have a lot of prayer involved in that. Wine growers, grape growers, can be struck by all sorts of things: phylloxera, by
rain,
frost,
disease,
bushfires,
mm-hmm,
bacteria. I mean, it's an
agricultural industry, and therefore, that's the great. One of the great drivers and excitement in a career about that is because each year is different through one reason or another. There's actually never a vintage that's like another one.
So there's no. Is there such thing as a perfect vintage?
There's near perfect vintages where, in some regions, the weather's right, the temperature's good, the grapes are of a good quality, and everything goes right in the winery. Because there's a lot of processes, as you were trying to describe, turning grapes into wine, and not all that goes according to plan sometimes.
Glenn, I'm interested in this very simplistic view I have of winemaking and how complicated is it?
It's simple because it's so simple that it's been done for millennia.
Right.
And grapes by themselves can turn themselves into alcohol, and that's why you get a lot of, you know, drunken animals in forests and things. Chimps and even grizzly bears can eat too many grapes or fruit and it ferments. In their gut and they're drunk. So the process of yeast turning sugars into alcohol is very easy. What the winemaker does is control that process.
So you're saying monkeys could do your job?
Yeah, it's probably.
Yeah, very kind of me, yeah, I know.
God. Yeah, it's a control process. So what we're trying to do is preserve those fresh fruit flavours that we have in grapes. So, and each grape has a different attribute, like Riesling or Chardonnay or Cabernet or Shiraz, all have different attributes, and it's preserving what that vineyard gives through a process of removing the juice from the skins.
Mm-hmm.
In red wine making, you ferment with the skins because that's where all the tannin and colour and flavour are. And then controlling that process so the yeast ferment well without farting and producing horrible smells like hydrogen sulfide, which is rotten egg gas.
Right.
And brewers have that same problem.
Well, it's interesting you say brewers. Mm. We're going to meet a brewer very shortly. Well, he's not the brewer, his brother is, but we're going to talk the process of making beer as well. Are you happy to stick with us for the hour?
Yeah, sure.
Excellent. Here we go. We've got a question before we go. Is a more expensive bottle of wine always better? And that's from Kiki. Mm. Now, this is the $64,000 question as well.
It's yes and no.
Mm.
There is, you know, the great wines of the world are expensive, and many of those are really great. There's also a lot of wine that you pay over $20 for. It's garbage.
Mm,
and
I've
you get
that.
A great wine at $9.99, honestly.
And a lot of wine is like perfume, is like food. It involves a lot of personal taste, doesn't it?
It's personal taste, as well as people just thinking they can buy some grapes, throw a label on it, and sell it for $25.
Excellent. When we come back, we will meet Andrew Ong, but I also want to talk to you today probably about the great Sauvignon Blanc myth. But we'll come to that very soon. You're with Pete Dillon and Glenn James on Cravings on Joy 94.9.
This is a podcast from Joy 94.9, a gay and lesbian volunteer-based community radio station.
Sitting in a chair beside me is the man that's responsible for my hangover. He is winemaker Glenn James. And having arrived in the studio with some very dangerous-looking equipment is Andrew Ong. Now, I'm fascinated by this story. This is Andrew's from Two Brothers Brewery. And he's going to tell us a bit of a story about how this brewery came to be a microbrewery in an industrial park in Moorabbin. Andrew, welcome to Cravings.
Welcome, thank you.
And Glenn, welcome back, of course.
Oh, thank you.
Two Brothers, how did it come about, you and your brother David?
My brother and I basically worked over in the States for a period of time, probably 7 or 8 years each, and we got used to the fantastic beers over there.
Mm-hmm.
And then we returned in about 2001, and my brother returned about 2005, and we thought, let's try and buy some really interesting and sessionable beers, and we couldn't really find anything that...
Interesting and...
And sessionable beers.
What's a sessionable beer?
Sessionable beer is a beer with a lot of character and something that's very easy to drink that perhaps you could have at least 6 or 8 pots.
And how is it the next morning?
Drink in moderation.
Oh, so we're having a bit of a session. This
that's
is a
right,
sessionable
yeah.
beer. Right, okay. Very good. As you were, continue.
And so we thought, okay, well, there's not a lot around. Let's see if we can try and make it ourselves. So we looked back to the market in the States, and Andrew had some commercial brewing experience with a brewery in Seattle, and we thought, well, try and acquire some equipment.
Mm-hmm.
The best place to do that was, at the time, Canada or the United States of America. So we waited carefully, and after about a year, something came up.
Now, this was in just off 42nd Street
that's
in Broadway
correct,
in New York City, yeah?
Correct. That's the Times Square Brewery.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a bit of a fire sale. Walt Disney was taking over the lease, and they basically wanted to chop up the equipment and get it out of there. So we actually made them a little offer. They gave us a little bit of time to rig the system out.
Mm-hmm.
And then...
There's an interesting story with getting this stuff from New York to New Jersey and then here.
That's right. Yes, we...
share it with us.
We The New York City Council wasn't very gracious in giving us a trucking permit or a collection of trucking permits to get the vats basically out of New York City to the port of New Jersey. So they basically said no. So we did it under the cover of darkness at about 2 a.m. in the morning, gradually filled up five 60-foot flatbed trucks and shipped the stuff over to New Jersey with one interruption by a New York City cop, and he just said, no problems, keep doing what you're
on
doing.
Your way.
On
yeah,
your way.
On your way, yeah.
So then you've brought it back to Australia, and you're in an industrial park in Moorabbin.
That's right. Fairly unlikely place, you'd think.
Well, no, size is obviously important when you're building a brewery.
That's right, yes.
And I imagine cost, you wouldn't want to be doing this on High Street in Windsor.
Probably wouldn't get the permit, and also, just the cost of the retail space would be too high for us.
So we're talking to Glenn about the winemaking process. Talk us very quickly. I know you're not the brewer. Your brother Andrew is the brewer.
Yep.
Talk us through the process of making beer.
Well, basically, we start out, for our size system, we produce about 2,000 litres of beer per batch, and we start out with about 400 kilos of grain, and that's cracked through a mill so that we can basically open up the grain husks for the mash process, where we... The beer will basically, or the grain, the cracked grain will basically sit in warm water at 60 degrees for about an hour, and we'll extract the sugars out, and then we'll end up with basically a porridge solution.
Is that your wort?
It becomes the wort. Yes,
the wort.
Yeah,
the wort.
The wort, not that's the wort.
So the wort is this congee looking thing.
Correct. Yes, and we have to then strain the liquid part component of that off into a boiler where we boil it for basically 1 hour, or depending on the recipe, it might be 90 minutes.
Mm.
And that's where we add our hops,
yep,
different stages for aroma and for flavour and for bitterness.
And do you have interesting hops? Because that's what makes a lot of beer very interesting, isn't
we
it?
We do. A lot of our hops, I think Andrew will let me tell you these secrets. A lot of the hops are from Northern America and from England.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think we actually use any local hops.
But now, Czech hops, I understand, are quite well-regarded in making beer as well, are they not?
They are, yes.
Yep. Okay. Sorry to interrupt you. I've got a very important message here. Greetings from Bali. We've got somebody listening on the stream in Bali, streaming in sweet and husky this morning. Any wine suggestions to go with my oysters tonight? And you could probably talk about beer with oysters as well. Should I go for... quantity or quality? Got a date and need all the help I can get. Thank you, Stu, for that delightful message. What are we having with oysters, boys? Beer or wine?
Well, for wine, you'd definitely go for something that's crisp and clean and pure.
Like me.
Yeah, not this morning, you're not. Not after your tequila. Crisp Chardonnays, like from cool climate areas to Riesling, and hate to say it, Sauvignon Blanc goes quite well.
Now, remembering we're in Ubud in the northern part of Bali, so some of these things may be a little hard to get.
A crisp dry white,
Well, what about beer?
I would say probably a lager or a nice pilsner, a European pilsner would be nice. Something that, again, is quite light. Maybe a little bit malty, but with a little bit of crispness to it as well.
Excellent. Yep. Stu, there you go. Enjoy your oysters and good luck with the date, sir. Now, back to this process. So we've strained the congee. We've got a liquid. What are we doing with it now?
We're boiling it up.
Yep.
And at the end of the boil, that's during the boil, we add all the hops. And at the end of the boil, we have to cool it down very quickly and transfer it into a fermenter, basically cooling it from 100 degrees down to 20 degrees.
Mm-hmm.
And then we pitch the yeast in. Otherwise, if we pitch the yeast in at a higher temperature, it will basically die. So
it cooks the yeast almost, doesn't it?
Correct, yes. And the yeast works best at certain temperatures depending on what you're making, whether it's a lager or an ale. And it ferments away for about 5 days.
Mm-hmm.
Then we condition it for 3 or 4 weeks. And then
you're speaking Dutch to me, remember?
Sorry about that. Yep.
Condition it. What does that mean?
Basically, to let the yeast settle out and to clarify the beer is a process that we undertake before we actually filter our beer. So we filter our beer... all of our beers, even our wheat beer,
yep,
so that we've got a nice, clean, consistent product, and that's done just prior to serving to the customers. It's a final stage thing, and then.
And this is the other thing. The customer comes into Two Brothers in
Moorabbin.
Moorabbin, yep. Off Cochrane's Road. And the tap is basically just there. This is coming straight from the vat.
Our taps are plumbed in directly to the bases of each tank, so it's basically the freshest way you can get beer, I believe, at the moment.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Now, you also do a bit of wood fire pizza business.
Yeah, we've got a truck that comes up on a Friday night, and they serve pizzas for a few hours on a Friday night, and people sit back in the beer hall and enjoy their pizzas with our six different beers on tap. So,
excellent. Now, give us a website so that we can direct people to it.
It's www.twobrothers.com.au, and it's the
number two, twobrothers.com.au. Yes. Yep. So they can have a look at, because there's some great photos on there of the site itself.
That's correct.
Yeah. They can get all the details on your beers. Now, we've got the growler, the taxi. Sorry, I'm looking at this.
That's all right.
I need to explain this equipment on the desk. The beers are a tomahawk, a taxi, a growler, and there's a fourth beer, is there not?
We've actually got six beers. I brought in what I thought were the three most interesting tap handles that you'll see around
now, town. Now, Glenn, we need to try and explain these tap handles. The first one you have in your hand is the blade of a chainsaw.
It is the top of the front bit of a chainsaw blade. Yes,
that's correct.
Yeah. Is this not an occupational health and safety issue?
It could be. We haven't had any complaints. We've got it at a few places, like the Fox and Mrs. Palmer's, and they haven't had any injuries there, so okay. they've been all right.
The next one is a yellow. Well, it looks like the sign of a New York taxi. And as you tip this, as you pull this to pour the beer, it lights up.
That's correct. We've got a little counterbalance in there, and it lights up to let you know that your beer's being poured.
Right, and this is the German Pilsner
beer, the German Pilsner, that's correct, yes.
And then you've got a tomahawk.
The tomahawk's one of our seasonal beers, right. And that's for the beer called the Chief, which is a Mürzen, which is basically a German red amber lager.
Right.
So it's basically like a really big lager at about 6.5%.
And this is a little mini tomahawk.
Yeah, it looks like something from the Stone Age. Yeah.
Well, it looks like something that's very dangerous.
No, everything's been blunted for safe bar use. So
marvellous, marvellous. Yeah. Now, we have a couple more text messages. This one from Dean Beck. Is it true that better quality wines don't give a hangover? Did you drink crap last night? Dean, to be frankly honest, I think my hangover has far more to do with tequila than it does with the Pinot Noir we drag. Does better quality booze make a lesser hangover? Wine or beer, but you probably could both answer this.
There's lots of theories on that, and the wine writer Max Allen actually did a test on himself. Mm-hmm. He drank all night, one night with cheap alcohol of all sorts, and then sort of wrote notes about it, and the next morning, and then did the same thing with high quality alcohol another time, and he had less of a hangover. So a hangover is often caused by some of the other shitty things in
like
alcohol.
Kebabs.
Cigarettes. There's alcohol isn't all alcohol. There's long-chain alcohols. There's different types of alcohol, and some are quite complex, and they are a bit more poisonous than just straight ethanol, which is poison.
So if we're drinking nasty VB...
Yes.
And we're drinking some of the Two Brothers sessionable
beers,
we're going to have a different hangover, aren't we?
Well, actually, I haven't tabulated this, but we've got a lot of guys that come around from the local industrial area that drink a lot, and they were previously VB drinkers, and we've converted them over to our taxi pilsner. And they'll have 10, 15, 20 pots and not have a headache the next day.
Lord.
So
it's like good vodka. It's very hard to get a hangover on good vodka.
Watch me try. David, thank you so much for joining us on Craving. I've learned something. People can get along to the brewery in Moorabbin. They can jump online to Two Brothers, that's with the number 2.org.au. And Stu says...
.com.au.
Joy is the .org.au in my head. And Stu said, thank you, guys. He will be enjoying both beer and wine with his oysters tonight.
This is a podcast from Joy 94.9. For more content, please go to our website at joy.org.au.
You're on Cravings on Joy 94.9. My name is Pete Dillon. Joining me, sort of co-hosting, co-driving, navigating me through this hour is winemaker Glenn James. And having just walked into the studio is a chef of great renown. We'll come to him in just a second. We have had some questions. Because you may have a question about Christmas in July. Scott Pickett, Merry Christmas in July.
Merry Christmas, Pete.
Today is the 25th of July, which means it's an opportunity to get completely sozzled in the middle of winter. But more importantly for you, it's about probably doing quite a traditional Christmas meal in the middle of the year in a winter season.
Oh, look, that's exactly right, Pete. I mean, we just wanted to do something that I've been celebrating with family and friends for a number of years, actually, mm-hmm. because we don't really get a cold Christmas in Australia, do you know what I mean? Most Christmas days I'm down the beach or doing something. And I lived in England for a few years, and I really enjoyed that sort of, you know, that cold winter feel where it's snowing and you rug up and that sort of thing. So it's sort of a tradition that, you know, we've had for about 5 or 6 years amongst family and friends, as I said, and it's something that I wanted to do at the point for a couple of years. And so, yeah, the big day's tomorrow, really, which is pea and ham soup to start with. Roast leg of lamb with all the trimmings, you know, like, you know, big crunchy, you know, roast potatoes.
Mint jelly,
you know, all that sort of thing. And then for dessert, we're having Christmas pudding with brandy anglaise and brandy butter.
Yum. I'm almost tempted to cancel all of my plans and get in there tomorrow. Now, of course, Scott Pickett is the executive chef at the Point Restaurant in Albert Park. I want to talk through your background because it's we're going to be talking a little later about putting Victoria on your table. It's seasonal food. You have a passion, as most chefs these days are saying, for seasonal produce. How did that come about? You were sort of trained in a French style of food?
Yeah, look, I'm classically French trained. I was lucky enough to work with Philippe Michel at three of his restaurants, actually, sort of Paul Bocuse before that shut down. And then we went to Langton's in Flinders Lane when that first opened. And the Brasserie at Crown as well, sort of over, you know, different years with the chef that I still call him the chef because he is, you know.
Well, that's an honorific term for anybody who is senior to you in a kitchen, isn't it? Yes. Hello, chef.
Yes.
I used to get in so much trouble in my younger days because I'm a chef.
Okay.
Or I'd have a qualification as a chef. I don't know that I can call myself a chef. I used to get in a great deal of trouble because I was working in 5-star hotels and we had an executive chef. To this day, I still only know as Klaus.
Yep.
And everybody would walk past him and, you know, he's this huge German man.
Yep.
And everyone would like, morning chef, morning chef, morning chef. Like, g'day, Klaus. And I'd get in all sorts of trouble because it was sort of.
I'm sure he probably didn't take that too well, being a strict German with a 5-star background. Probably.
I think it was actually Swiss. If I tell the truth. So you learned your training under Philippe Michel.
Look, that's where the classical French training comes in, and we probably cook sort of modern European now. But I did my apprenticeship in South Australia in a little country restaurant in McLarenvale called the Slopian Inn.
Oh, I was there very recently.
Yeah,
it's fantastic.
It's a fantastic place, and that was truly. I mean. Look, I'm born in Melbourne, and I lived here till I was 12, but my father's from South Australia, and he was born and raised in Clarendon. So when I was 12, we went back to South Australia, and my folks are still there in a little farm in Kangaroola, and I did my apprenticeship at the Slopian Inn. And that was
the chef
at the time there was Andrew Summers.
Do we know him?
Not really, not now. Look, he's... Right. Andy's a great chef. He's an Englishman. He's now at Regency Park, and he runs the Le Cordon Bleu cooking school there now.
Right.
And he's big into training and that sort of stuff. And I suppose just the whole sort of Salopian philosophy was, you know, seasonal ingredients and local produce and stuff that was around. You know, we used to have a guy by the name of Ray, and Ray's cherries were on in summer. And the farmer would actually walk through the back door with, like, a... like a big ice cream bucket just full of his hand-picked cherries, and they just go on the menu that day. And that was really sort of where my love for the seasons really started. You know,
we can't do that anymore, though, can we? We're very much bound by regulation and legislation around food production.
Yeah, and it's got to come in a registered van at the right temperature, and everything's got to be checked and all that sort of stuff.
I am sure there's still folk walking into the back doors of kitchens to this very day, dropping off fish or...
Or
cherries
figs or peaches
figs.
And what's around.
You know, I'm sure it still happens. So you followed Philippe Michel to London?
Well, no, I went to London after about a year and a half at Langton's. And then I worked in a 2-star Michelin called The Square.
Oh, under Philip Howard.
Under Philip Howard, yeah.
Fabulous bloke.
Yeah, with Phil for 3 years, which only went for 12 months. And I just got so absorbed in Phil's, you know, philosophy and his manner and his food and, you know, just the whole thing that I stayed 3.5 years.
He was here for the Melbourne Food and Wine Festival this year and did a masterclass that I did with him. Extraordinary bloke and ridiculously gentle sort of fellow. Now, Glenn might be able to help us with this next point. You've now started wines. You've got your own brand of wines at the point.
Yeah, that's being produced by De Bortoli just for us, our house reds, whites and stuff, which has just started, which is something else that we wanted to do because we've got a close association with them, obviously,
mm-hmm.
and just to sort of produce our own stuff. So they just, go and hand select and do little, small amounts for us.
So what's the white? It's a Semsav Blanc?
Yes.
And the red is?
Is a Shiraz and a Cab Sav.
Excellent. This is going to bring me back. The reason I'm working in circles here, because I'm getting back to this great Sauvignon Blanc debate. There are those in the school that say real wine drinkers don't drink Sauv Blanc.
Yeah.
There are those on the other side of the fence that say, screw you real wine drinkers, we like Sauv Blanc.
Yeah.
Glenn, why is this such a contentious issue?
It's probably a tall poppy thing there anyway. But look, Sauvignon Blanc came out of nowhere, really. Obviously, New Zealand created a wine style. The grape suits New Zealand, and it produces easily recognisable flavours. You can say the name.
Tropical, passion fruity, herbaceous.
All those tropical flavours, and people know what they're going to taste when they pour it into the glass.
Yep.
And the myriad of different brands, let alone the different varieties, and what to expect, like a Chardonnay, can be really oaky and alcoholic, or it can be very light, fine, and tropical in itself.
Mm-hmm.
Sauvignon Blanc's generally going to be pretty much down one kind of road. And so it's.
Now, is this New Zealand Sauv Blanc, Marlborough region Sauv Blanc is all identifiable almost?
Apart from a few funky ones that have been now using natural yeasts, dirty juice, a bit of old oak, getting some complex, more Euro French. Sancerre type wines, but generally, yes, it's all in very much in the same tropical, grassy mode.
But then we've got producers here in Australia who are making Sauv Blancs, obviously not tacking onto the back of the success of the New Zealand Sauv Blancs, but I've been drinking recently a Sauv Blanc from Kinloch Estate, which is King Valley Way.
Okay, yeah.
And it's nothing like a New Zealand Sauv Blanc. It's actually a really palatable wine. That having been said, I'm as guilty as anybody of walking into a bottle store and buying a bottle of Oyster Bay, because I know that exactly what it's going to taste like.
Yep.
And
Oyster Bay is the biggest selling white wine in the country.
Correct. You're with Pete Dillon on Cravings on Joy 94.9. It's about 17 minutes to 2. I can't believe the time's already gone. Guys, I want to talk to you about... and both of you can weigh in on this argument. When you deal with something all day, like you do with food and like you do, Glenn, with wine, what do you do when you go home?
Look, I eat simple things when I'm at home. I mean, I'm normally in the kitchen about 9 in the morning and I don't really get home much before midnight. So I rarely eat when I get home. And if I do, it might just be simple, stuff like a toasty, a ham and cheese toasty or stuff. But on my days off... When I'm not on the golf course, I don't get much time for that these days, unfortunately, either. But look, I normally do slow braises, especially this time of year, just one pot sort of wonders, where I can cook off the veg and red wine and shallots and mushrooms and braised beef or lamb or something like that. And it's just, and I just pop the Le Creuset in the oven and come back a couple of hours later and it's ready and reduced and nice to eat, and that's pretty much it.
Excellent. Glenn, I know that you do enjoy a good wine when you get home.
Yeah, well...
Or when you come to visit from South Australia.
Well, it's... and some days, you're coming home and it can be off the back of 100, maybe 200 wines during the day.
I've tasted.
Particularly during blending times and so-called classification when the vintage is finished and we're... got many, many different wines and deciding how we're going to blend them.
So is that when you come home and have a beer?
I used to have a beer, not really drinking much beer at the moment.
You'd be drinking Two Brothers beer now.
Well, I'm looking at right now, a giant jug in front of me.
Keep your eyes off it. I'm seeing you coveting this. You're not going to.
I do like a gin and tonic at the end of the day, but... I'm always looking towards the future. I'm looking for exciting things and wishing we were doing that here in Australia right now, and I'm looking at... good Pinots, Italian and Spanish varieties, really exciting. So if I wander past a shop on the way home or whatever, or have something stored up, I'm looking for things that are going to be the future, the next things that Australia can grow and make much better than just Shiraz and Cabernet and Chardonnay.
And next time you're in Melbourne, we're going to talk about that, I think, because it's something that it's like looking into a crystal ball, I suppose. It's looking into the future. Speaking of the future, in a few minutes we'll be speaking to Natalie O'Brien, who is the CEO of the Melbourne Food and Wine Festival. They're currently running a program called Put Victoria on Your Table. We've had an SMS regarding Sauvignon Blanc, and I am almost inclined to agree with this correspondent who hasn't given us their name. You just can't go wrong with a New Zealand Sauv Blanc. I would have it for breakfast if it was allowed. Pop it on your Wheaties and see how you go. This is Cravings on Joy 94.9, and I'm in agreeance with a text message we've just received. Great show. I think it's a tremendous show. Thank you. Thank you to our texters. And on the telephone right now is the CEO of the Melbourne Food and Wine Festival. Her name is Natalie O'Brien. Afternoon, Nat.
Good afternoon, everyone, on a very chilly, chilly day.
It's a very chilly, chilly day. I'm glad that you're outside and I'm inside.
Oh, I'm actually indoors, but it's a little cold indoors.
I heard rumour that you've been at an organic festival.
I have this morning, and I was there right on 10 o'clock, and lots of long queues heading into the Organic Expo, but it was great.
Excellent. Now, in the studio with me, I have winemaker Glenn James from Foster's. Say hello, Glenn.
Hi, Natalie. I was at the organic market there at a show at 10 o'clock as well. It's absolutely amazing.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
It's wonderful to see so many people out and about having a look at it.
And so much good food and wine there.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Sorry, and Scott Pickett's with us. Scott is the exec chef of the Point at Albert Park.
Good afternoon, Scott. How are you?
Yeah, very good, Natalie. How are you going? Good.
Very well, very well.
That's good.
Now, Natalie, the reason we're talking to you is a new sort of winter campaign that the Melbourne Food and Wine Festival has started called Put Victoria on the Table, on your table. Talk us through briefly what this is about. Obviously, there's a desire to use local produce, is that...?
Absolutely, and we thought... this whole concept is broad enough for everyone to participate, whether that's at home cooking your own meals, heading out to a market, looking out for Victorian, going to your local bottle shop and picking out a gorgeous bottle of Victorian wine, or heading out to dinner or lunch, and again, choosing from a menu that has got a number of Victorian products. So we sort of thought that it was a great initiative to launch in winter when it's a bit harder to get people out, but really something that should spread out over the whole year.
I was talking off air whilst we were listening to that groovy little mashup we were listening to about... Because I noticed there's folks with meat, with cheese, with seafood, to wine. I was talking about pork, and Scott was saying that there is a woman here in Victoria who's growing amazing black Berkshire pigs.
Yeah, fantastic. Her company's called Western Plains Pork, and it's about 45 minutes sort of just outside Geelong, and her name's Judy Crow. And she's been doing pork for, you know, 10 or 15 years. And she does the little suckling pigs, and I use those sometimes too. And obviously Adrian Richardson from La Luna is, you know, famous for his sort of suckling pigs as well. But I was just telling Pete earlier on too that I've actually been doing two pigs a week for about the last 6 or 7 weeks because it's our salami making season. And so we've got, you know, about 20 legs of prosciutto hanging around the place at the moment, and that's where our sort of whole winter warmer roast started to use the pork racks up, and it's great, you know, ties in with the Victorian theme.
Oh, it's amazing, and I think I absolutely defer to Scott when it comes to pigs and meat. But, you kind of think of winter and think, you know, what is there to be had? But as you say, all the beautiful slow cooks, game, pigs, all the root vegetables and interesting beetroots are just gorgeous at the moment. And so when you really get down to think of it and get out to the markets and get out for dinner, you realise there's some really lovely produce around at this time of year.
Nat, how important do you think our good mate Matt Preston on MasterChef, how important do you think MasterChef was? It's not a question I've asked Scott, probably for obvious reasons. I wonder, there's been this new enthusiasm for food. I've got friends who threatened their four-year-old children that if they didn't behave, they wouldn't watch MasterChef.
Well, it's really interesting. In fact, I caught up with Matt last Friday for lunch, and... I think that a large part of his audience is that younger audience, which I think is just fantastic.
Mm.
I'm also sort of involved with Stephanie's Foundation, and that's obviously sort of a dedicated program for kids to learn. But I think the fact that kids were watching this on television, starting to want to cook with their parents, getting involved in the shopping and things like that, I think that's a great outcome for a show like that.
Mm.
and to get people enthused. And I heard there were run-ons on Croquembouche tins, people rushing out of, to the pastry episode they have, which I just think is brilliant.
I think it's insane. They're so bloody difficult to make.
Well, we when I grew up, Mum did them quite differently. In fact, we had a cardboard cone and we would put it on the outside. This was sort of, it looked much more complicated, and again, Scott will know his way of doing it, to actually stick it in and get it out without breaking.
Yeah. It is really very difficult. Bonkers. Now, coming back to putting Victoria on the table, so you're suggesting you support a local farmer, a fisher, a winemaker, people who are making cheese?
Absolutely, and I guess we've kind of pulled together loads of ideas of how you might be able to put Victoria on your table, and there's a number of independent and licensed bottle shops who are actually sort of profiling Victorian wine for the next 2 weeks.
Yep.
The campaign kicks off tomorrow. We're doing a winter indoor cellar door tasting. And
At Crown
Palladium. We've got 80 wineries heading from every corner of the state to come down and do tastings. There's also a number of artisan cheese producers and bread makers that will be there to complement the wine. So that would be sort of a great activity to launch the 2 weeks. And then, of course, Restaurant Express, where you can have two courses, again, featuring Victorian produce.
The points. Now, people can go to the website and to your website at Melbourne Food
wine.com.au.
Lovely.
And you'll see the list of all the restaurants, including the point, that are participating. There's also a lovely little new event, which is called Pies and Pinot. And there's about 50 gastropubs around the state that are putting on special pies. And the innovation's incredible. I think there's wallaby, there's wild rabbit, there's mushroom, there's all sorts of gorgeous pies coming together. And then the farmers markets. And what they've got to do for consumers is actually spike all of the products and produce that they have that are actually Victorian. So when you're heading down to Param Market or Queen Vic Market or to your local farmers market, you'll be able to identify what cheese actually comes from, you know, Victoria, and put that on your table when you're cooking at home as well.
Excellent. So this kicks off tomorrow, the 26th of July. Runs for 2 weeks.
Absolutely. And the activities run for 2 weeks. But as I said, I think the whole campaign is really about what we should be doing year-round in terms of supporting local and Victorian, not just because it's Victorian, but because it's great quality.
And that the website address again?
Is melbournefoodandwine.com.au.
Natalie O'Brien, CEO of the Melbourne Food and Wine Festival, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, and I hope to see everyone tomorrow for a little glass of wine.
Oh, I promised I wouldn't drink on Sunday. It's the Lord's Day of rest.
I don't believe you.
Nat.
Take care. Thank you.
Thank you. And thanks also to Scott Pickett and Glenn James for joining me on this little galloping gourmet journey around Victoria. This has been Cravings with Pete Dillon. Thank you to Glenn James, David Ong, Scott Pickett and Natalie O'Brien. Next week, we're blessed by a Burgundian winemaker, Pierre Nejean, joins us here in the studio. But until then, go out and crave.
This has been another Joy 94.9 podcast. Joy 94.9 is a gay and lesbian volunteer-based community radio station committed to providing a voice for the diverse GLBTI communities. You can support our work by becoming a member or making a donation. For details, go to joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast, brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.